Recording in progress.
All right, Ms. Jones, you had an announcement about the sign-in sheets, and then I'll jump in after you.
Correct. For members of the public who wish to comment during the public comment portion, there are sign-up sheets at the back of the room by the doors. Right before we launch into that section of the hearing, we'll just pull those so we can call people in order, but we'll leave one back there just in case anybody misses the chance to sign up. And public testimony will be limited to 3 minutes each, so we'll have just a little timer just to keep things kind of flowing smoothly. But that's kind of the process that we'll be doing for that.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Jones, and welcome everybody to Kitsap County hearing this morning. For the record, it's January 8th, 2025, 9:30 a.m. I'm Phil Albrecht, the hearing examiner for Kitsap County, holding a hearing this morning on a couple permit applications as well as an appeal, administrative appeal. The permit applications are for preliminary plat and the shoreline conditional use permit. The file and permit numbers are 23-03239 for the plat and 23-03929 for the conditional use permit. The name of the project is Meadowdale Subdivision. As I said, I'm the hearing examiner for Kitsap County. I work for 35 cities and counties throughout the state of Washington, from all the way down from Shelton, Washington, from Mason County up to the cities of Blaine and Port Townsend. It's my job basically to find out if the application should be approved, and that's based on whether or not they comply with the permit criteria. And the reason why cities and counties use hearing examiners instead of having their elected officials make the decision is because the courts require that the decisions be based on the permit criteria, not on how many people are opposed to a project or something of that nature. And a lot of cities have incurred substantial liability for failing to follow that rule. And so the best way that they can handle it and do it correctly is to essentially hire people like me to do that for them. Because if you don't base the decision on the criteria, the court just makes you approve it anyway and then makes cities and counties hand over a bunch of taxpayer money to the applicants for not doing it correctly. So the fortunate thing about this process, though, is that permitting criteria are very broad. Basically, any bad adverse impacts that it has on you as a community member are often relevant to the permit criteria, whether it be traffic impacts or impacts to wildlife or wetlands or streams. All those kind of things are relevant and something that I take very seriously when I look this over. There's a lot of work that goes into these permit applications, traffic studies, drainage studies, studies that address impacts to streams and lakes and that kind of thing. A lot of documents and expertise goes into making these final decisions. And how this hearing format is a little different from other ones. Usually in these land use hearings, we just have a permit application, one or two, and the applicant starts off, or rather the staff starts off giving us an overview of what the project is about. Then the applicant gets to make their pitch for approval, and then we move on to public comments. We go back to staff to answer questions. The applicant gets final word. I get a couple weeks to issue a final decision. It's a little different about this one is we'll start off the first part of the hearing with that format, but this hearing also includes what they call a SEPA appeal. SEPA stands for the State Environmental Policy Act. A lot of you have probably heard about environmental impact statements. I know, from reading your public comments, I know a lot of you actually know quite a bit about SEPA and what's involved, but basically, the SEPA appeal, the State Environmental Policy Act appeal, is disputing the county SEPA responsible official's decision that an environmental impact statement isn't necessary for this project. And the central inquiry in whether or not you have to do that environmental impact statement is whether this proposal will create probable significant adverse environmental impacts. And if it does, then you need to do that environmental impact statement that does an in-depth study. And I'll say, the majority of projects, in this state, a lot of them, a lot smaller than this one, don't require environmental impact statements. It's fairly rare that they are required. A project of this scale, though, that's certainly not out of the question. And we're going to have a big portion of this appeal going on for several days is going to be assessing whether or not that decision was correct, that an environmental impact statement wasn't necessary for this project. The nice thing about the appeal for those of you concerned about impacts to the community is that instead of being limited to 3 minutes to discuss those impacts, like I said, we're going to spend several days assessing all of the concerns I think you had in your written statements have been encompassed for the most part in that SEPA appeal. Today, we'll just be dealing with the public comments. We're not going to get to the SEPA appeal hearing, you know, probably not, maybe this afternoon, but certainly not this morning. But those of you who want to, you know, watch what's going on with the SEPA appeal, you're all welcome to join in the web link to the virtual part of the hearing where we keep going on with that SEPA appeal. Ms. Jones there can give you the link if you don't have it. It should be in the public notice requirements. Those of you who don't have a computer, you know, let Ms. Jones know, and probably the county can work something out where you can watch it from a county facility, because these are public hearings. They have to be open to the public. See what else. Yeah, also just to say, you know, I usually, when it's a hit project that's going to involve a lot of public interest, I like to be there in person. But in this case, since we have a big appeal portion, if I were to attend today's portion in person, then all the expert witnesses that the appellants have hired and that the applicant has hired, that kind of thing, would all feel compelled to attend the hearing as well. And that really drives up the cost of the hearing. So, you know, doing these things virtually is still a little new. We just started doing this with the pandemic, of course, and so still kind of figuring out what the proper balance is between in-person and virtual attendance. But for most hearings, virtual is a much more economical way to do this for everybody. Something that's this big, you know, it's you know, it's debatable whether or not it's best to attend in person. But I see that we have a lot of people attending virtually as well, a lot of members of the public. It's nice to have that additional option for public participation anyway. So with that, now by state law, and this is really important, by the way, as a hearing examiner, as a decision maker in a land use proceeding, I'm not allowed to talk to anybody about this project. All the information that I review should be information that's available to everybody else, so you all know exactly what's being considered for that final decision. I'm not allowed to talk to staff about the merits of the proposal. I can talk to them about scheduling the hearing. Obviously, that has to be done one way or another. But I don't talk to them about, you know, whether or not it meets the permit criteria or ask them to do another study or anything like that. I'm just not allowed to do that. Same, I can't talk to the applicant, to the neighbors, anybody. So it's real important that we define exactly, you know, what documents are part of the record. And staff has prepared a staff report, and in that staff report, they've also identified the studies that they believe are necessary to consider when making the final decision on this. And I'm going to share my screen here. Let's see, show you the exhibit list. The staff report has an exhibit list. There we go. You should hopefully see that, and I'll give you a really rough overview of the kind of documents the staff is looking at. As I said, there's what's called a critical areas report, which assesses impacts to affected streams in the lake itself. The habitat management plan, same thing about the environmentally sensitive portions of the project. A lot of work goes into the stormwater review. That's always a big part of a subdivision review. Traffic impacts, of course, we had a traffic impact analysis done. We've also done concurrency tests, essentially tests whether or not, you know, we're going to have adequate facilities, adequate traffic facilities. Geotechnical report dealing with soils and the stability for developing that particular area. And let's see, like I said, a lot of habitat, civil landscape plans for the project. And of course, the public comments, we've got quite a few, about 70 of them. I've read through all of them, and the notices that were involved in the project. So the staff report at this point, when it was written a week or two ago, just goes up to 59. And I'm going to stop share on that one. There have been some additional documents submitted since then, or presented for consideration. Hold on a sec here. All right. Oops. All right, so additional documents that have come in since the staff report are a few more public comment letters, Exhibit 60 from the Fenton, Exhibit 61 from Brennan. We also had a cultural resources assessment dealing with you know, artifacts, that kind of thing, in project site. 63 is a hydrologic assessment. 64, comment from the Squamish tribe, and 65, another comment from Mr. Shorett. So those are I believe, Ms. Jones, are those all the exhibits so far for the staff analysis?
So far, those are all of the exhibits, and I can confirm I did receive the attachments for exhibit number 65, and those are available now in the Dropbox.
Okay, perfect. All right, so at this point, I just want to ask if anyone has any objections to entry of those documents in the record or needs to see them. If somebody needs to see them, Ms. Jones can give you a link to view those documents, but objections at this stage in the proceeding, it's not a time to, you know, to dispute your view versus the view of the experts, you know, that wrote the technical reports, that whether or not these documents are relevant to the proceeding or, you know, whether or not they're authentic. There might be, say, a mistake. There was a photograph of that's in that list that actually doesn't show the project site, but something else. So at this point, I just want to ask if there are any objections. If you do, just click on the raise hand button at the bottom of your screen. Or if you're in the meeting room, just wave your hand and Ms. Jones will recognize you. And I see we do have a raised hand from Ms. Koloskova, so I'll let her chime in. She's the counsel representing the applicant. So Ms. Koloskova, you have a problem with one of the exhibits, or?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Hearing Examiner. This is Duana Koloskova. I am the attorney for the applicant here, and I would just request if we could get copies of the comments that have come in. I don't believe that I have seen those, and I'm not sure that my team has seen those. So would appreciate if Ms. Jones could forward those. It would be super so that we can be responding to those in a timely fashion.
All right. Ms. Jones, can you do that?
Yes, I can provide those.
Okay. And Ms. Koloskova, I'll leave the, you know, if you have any objections, just let me know by the end of the hearing as to those additional exhibits. But beyond that, I haven't heard any objections for exhibits 1 through 60, I believe it was, or 1 through 59. So I'll go ahead and admit those. And exhibit 60 through, what was that number again? Through 65 are admitted, subject to the right of applicant to object to them before the end of the hearing is concluded. So with that, who's going to be doing our staff presentation today?
Darren Gurney.
Okay, Mr. Gurney, let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Okay. First, I would like to request that the exhibits 60 through 65 come back up. I wasn't able to actually see them on the screen.
Okay.
Real well.
Yeah, there. There you go.
Okay. Thank you. That helps.
All right.
So I guess to start for the presentation, for the record, my name is Darren Gurney. I am a planning supervisor here at Kitsap County Department of Community Development and project lead for this project. The just a couple of things to start with on the project and for the PowerPoint today. As always, I mentioned that the PowerPoint presentation is something that supplements a staff report. It is not meant to replace it. We provide some clarifications based on comments received, and we address some themes in our presentation that aren't necessarily easy to pull out of a staff report. So with that, it looks like we have added the appropriate exhibits. I do want to note that there may be a geotechnical addendum I thought was going to be added to that list of exhibits. I'm not sure if we got that to you as one of those. I believe it was in the original exhibit list in the index, but I'm going to confirm that before the hearing is over.
Okay.
So with that, as you mentioned, this is a shoreline conditional use permit and preliminary plat permit running through concurrent review and going through the hearing examiner for the approvals. The shoreline conditional use permit, just for clarification, that is something that the reviewing authority rests with Department of Ecology, and the hearing examiner provides a recommendation of approval or denial to Ecology for that final decision to be rendered. One piece of clarification, I noticed that we We mentioned this was Meadowdale. We have another project in the county called Meadowdale. This is Meadowview. So just to clarify for anyone online and in the audience today. Something unrelated to the presentation, parking. I want to be respectful of those in the audience today. Our parking around the county building is primarily two-hour parking, so we may give an indication that we need a break to allow people to move their cars and not receive a ticket, which I have received a few, so they're not inexpensive. And lastly, I just want to mention that this project does carry with it some intense emotion and attachments to this project site. The county recognizes that, and the county is required to review a project as to whether it meets code. And our staff report and our decisions and recommendations are based on the code, even if we can empathize with those sentiments on the property. So getting to the technical part of our presentation. So this is the process that we went through. So you have the applicant of Sequoia Springs, complete applications. We submitted a notice of application that was then revised and sent back out and published to the public, notified nearby property owners. We issued a SEPA mitigated determination of non-significance that, as you know, was appealed through two parties. And we also received 70 written comments from over 41 separate interested parties. And those 70 comments do not include those we received up to the hearing date. So that is actually a little bit more. For those comments, the staff is not required to, but we did provide a comment response matrix to at least focus our responses and try and provide direct response to some of the concerns expressed or support of the project. That is in Exhibit H of the staff report. And finally, the complexity of this project could be, it is very confusing for this project. So there's a little bit of a timeline piece that we're going to go through as well. And the project itself, as the hearing examiner, you probably know, the index over 2,000 pages long, the comments received over 200 pages worth of comments. I have reviewed every page of those comments. And I just want to ensure the public that we do review every comment that comes through for the reports and for the project consideration. So context for the project site in Kitsap County. We are located in the central portion of Kitsap County. Although it is in Commissioner District 1, it is right on the edge of Commissioner District 3 as well. This is part of that timeline I was referring to for different projects. So initially this project with the history, we received the department received an application for cottage housing development, which is a permitted use in our use tables, and that requires a site development activity permit. That permit is at a 90% design level. It does not include the land use of a conditional use permit or an administrative conditional use permit. From this SDAP, that was based on cottage housing, a townhome kind of development. There was a meeting between the community and the applicants that discussed the project at this stage. That's not required by code, but we encourage it to reach out to the community. At that time, it was a rental only for the structures on site. It then went to the same site plan, but went to an ownership model. And through state law, an ownership model would require a binding site plan, which endures the same process, hearing examiner approvals, same process as a preliminary plat. And that binding site plan, in theory, is honing in on hardscape, softscape, making sure that everything is there as a guiding document for eventual construction documents. From that, from the binding site plan, the permit actually transitioned and new permits were filed that followed the same design premises in those first two, but it went into a single family residential subdivision model. That being, it's creating individual parcels instead of one large parcel with multiple townhomes on it. So that's where we are today. And that preliminary plat, that then triggered the shoreline conditional use permit. And as part of our Title 22, it indicates that a subdivision of a parcel that's within a shoreline jurisdiction must get that shoreline conditional use permit through ecology. And I'm doing this a little differently today. Usually I put goals and policies towards the end of a presentation, but I wanted to identify that we have land use goals and policies from our comprehensive plan, which is a document adopted by the Board of County Commissioners with significant amounts of public input. And that identifies the goals and policies of the vision of how our county will develop over time. And the emphasis for our comp plan is to allow residential development in urban growth areas and encourage that while protecting critical areas. And while we encourage development in urban growth areas, we allow development in rural locations. So this is specifically a project within the urban growth area, except for the stormwater ponds, which we'll get into. And these policies, goals and policies are listed in the staff report, so I'm not going to recite what's on the screen. Might be a little difficult to read, but this is a list of codes that we consult for our projects. For this project specifically, you'll see Title IX, health, welfare, sanitation. We review to ensure that it's not going to adversely impact health when you have a sewer station or septic systems, things like that. Water quality is part of that health and welfare indirectly. When we get into roads, highways, and bridges, we review against Kitsap County road standards and concurrency. Stormwater, we're looking at water quality and quantity. And for this project, we have stormwater that goes to dispersion trenches as well as two large stormwater ponds on the eastern parcel. Water systems and sewers. We have affidavits or agreements from Silverdale Water District and Kitsap County Sewer that the project site will be served for the number of units. We also identify in buildings and construction, that's not necessarily directly part of the project, but we condition at PPLAT that future permits are going to be needed for buildings and construction. So that's your vertical construction, retaining walls, houses, any kind of structures that may be above ground. Flood hazard areas, this is something we look at to confirm that something is not being built in a flood hazard area that could be a threat to life and safety of residents. So there are some locations that are on the site towards Island Lake. The project does stay out of those areas that may get flooded. Land division and development in Title 16, this is for that preliminary plat. This is the guiding document of urban standards. You need access and circulation elements, utilities. It ensures that you have the proper easements. And it also is dictating how that subdivision should be shown on a map so that the subsequent permits will be informed by that the approved documents. Title 17 zoning, this is one of our biggest titles in the entirety of Kitsap County Code. That's going over allowed uses, which single family residences are an allowed use per Kitsap County Code 17410. It also goes into the design regulations for each of those parcels when a building is constructed it talks about your zoning setbacks from the parcel edge, and that's put on the face of the final plat that if when somebody comes in with a building permit, here are your parcel setbacks. It's also getting into the general for the plat of landscaping through 17500, the amount of landscaping, how it's installed, whether there are buffers required. And so for this project, we have buffers required on all edges. On the northwestern and southern edges, those are separation buffers, and I'll show you a little bit later. And then on the eastern edge and surrounding the stormwater facilities, you have a solid screen buffer, which is 100% buffer, to screen those elements from adjacent properties. Title 18 is our SEPA chapter that is going into the process, the thresholds for SEPA determination, and the process that we have to pursue. For a mitigated declaration of non-significance, there's something very specific to note. So you mentioned in your initial comments that environmental impact statements are rare, sometimes warranted. Usually those environmental impact statements are such that our codes, Kitsap County codes, cannot address the impacts. The mitigated negative declaration, that is something where there are impacts and there's mitigation and code that prompts improvements be made offsite to mitigate the impacts from the project, which is what we have before you today. If there's nothing off-site and our codes can address everything and mitigate the impacts, for example, if you have impacts from lighting, we have code that says that lighting shall be downcast. That's an example of where our code specifically will address it. It can be done on-site and be render a decision of non-significance at that point. I'll try and go through these a little quicker here, but Title 19 Critical Areas Ordinance, that is our guiding code for wetlands, for streams, geologic hazard areas, critical area aquifer recharge areas, and we have a plethora of reports from this project. We have a habitat management plan that addresses those fish and wildlife areas and the shoreline. We have the critical areas report that's identifying where Barker Creek, associated wetlands, those elements are around the site. The geotechnical reports with drilling plot holes to determine whether there are instability factors or if slopes are going to be safe for future development. And then one of the points of contention that we are bringing forward is the hydrogeological assessment. Typically is not required for residential development, but that was provided by the applicant at a later date in response to comments. That is added to our list of exhibits. Moving on, so Title 21 gives us our procedures and what's needed for our permits to review them. And then finally, Title 22, our Shoreline Master Program, that's getting into identifying our shoreline jurisdiction that is applicable, the vegetative buffers that are associated with that. You have a standard buffer and reduced standard buffer, which I'll get into in just a moment. And that shoreline jurisdiction is basically any water that is statewide significance within 200 feet of that ordinary high water mark is part of the Shoreline Master Program. So this will be quicker now that I get to the visuals. Existing setup for the project site, you have a commercial recreation / resort. I believe it's Christa Camp Ministry that had this project site. It has a sentimental value to many in the area. I know a couple of employees that have actually gone there in the past, but you do have a site that is currently developed. It is heavily wooded. And you do have a small dock at Island Lake that when we get into the shoreline component of this, it's something to be noted that the dock is not intended to be used for any kind of it's not going to be enhanced from what I've seen, but the applicant may have a better ability to speak to that. So zoning, the yellow zoning you see here is urban low, 5 to 9 dwelling units per acre, and carries with it setbacks of 20 feet, 5 on the sides, and I believe 5 on the rear. Rural residential, the parcel on the east, that is where the stormwater ponds for the project site are located through project easements. And this zoning is what we use to determine both what's an allowed use, as I mentioned, single family residential, and the densities that are allowed, which is that 5 to 9 dwelling units per acre. Project location, the aerial photo here. Part of this photo is to demonstrate that to the northwest, south, and to the northeast, you have a single family residential pattern of development. So on almost 3/4 around this property, you have the same type of development that is proposed here. To the south of the upper parcel, I don't know if our pointer can show on the screen. There you go. Thank you. So that is Emerald Heights Elementary School, which is part of the justification that we use for requiring pedestrian connection, safe routes to schools. Should be noted that that school is technically in a different district than the residents that would be on these parcels. So critical areas maps, we use these maps. It's the latest information we have for critical areas in Kitsap County GIS. The pink indicates that there's a geologic potential for erosion. There are some orange pieces in here. Those are landslide potential. And those elements are addressed in the geotechnical reports to ensure that there is a safe site for development, as well as ensuring that erosion control measures are in place both temporarily and permanently for construction. This also shows our creek systems and wetlands. So you'll see that there is, on our maps, it's indicated there is a non-fish type stream running from southwest to northeast to the bottom of the lake. That stream was identified as not being a stream through the stream ID team. That includes Department of Fish and Wildlife, the tribes, and Kitsap County, which went out and traversed the site to identify whether those streams exist as defined in our code and kind of mark out those locations. Barker Creek, as you can see, comes down from Island Lake through a control feature. That control feature at the south of the lake maintains the lake levels, which is very critical for the community, as well as this is a Silverdale Water District area, and there's groundwater recharge that occurs here. So the hydrogeologic features here, it's important to note that the reports are addressing those features and our recommendations from the county. This is part of our critical areas mapping features. It's showing all red because this is a critical area, aquifer recharge area 1. The importance of that is in code, Kitsap County Code 19600. It identifies specific uses that would prompt a hydrogeological report. As I mentioned, residential is not included in that list that prompts the report. It's primarily industrial and commercial uses that would require things like a spill plan should you have oils or chemicals that are spilled. And those are usually associated with those industrial uses. But as I mentioned, the applicant did prepare that hydrogeological report and provided it as an exhibit to add to our list. This is our shoreline jurisdiction map. You'll note that there is a yellow portion on the urban parcel. That is our Urban Conservancy shoreline designation. And the green is our Rural Conservancy. The jurisdiction, as mentioned, is 200 feet from the shoreline edge. And the project itself does not include parcels inside that 200-foot jurisdiction. It keeps all of those parcels out of it. The There's a component of the project that goes towards the lake that includes non-water oriented recreation and viewing areas, which is one of the key tenets of our Shoreline Master Program, is to provide access to the shoreline for the public. Something to note, it is in the staff report, but access to the water itself is primarily achieved through going to the Kitsap County Park on the north edge that has a public access point instead of going through this project site. To address impacts to shoreline jurisdictions, we require a habitat management plan. This would include no net loss and a cumulative impact assessment to see if the same type of developments in the area would have a cumulative impact that is significant. One thing to note, after reviewing the staff report, the department mentions that the standard buffer of 85 feet, I want to make sure that we highlight that the standard buffer is actually 100 feet. The reduced standard buffer is 85 feet. And the reduced standard buffer, to achieve that, you have to demonstrate no net loss for impervious surfaces that are added. At this stage, the no net loss, we review that through the site development activity permit, because then that is the 90% design level. So your mitigation for the trails and the area that is, the picnic area and recreation components, if it has less impervious surface, then there's less mitigation required. So we defer to the SDAP for this project for that no net loss component. And if that cannot be met at SDAP, then those pieces cannot move forward. This is the project site plan for 329 parcels. You can see on the southeastern edge outside the urban parcel boundaries, you have two large stormwater ponds adjacent to Barker Creek, but still outside of the vegetative buffers required. This also demonstrates that you have a connection to Camp Court Road on the north. As you move down through the site, you will also have pedestrian connections that go to Emerald Heights Elementary School, which is being shown here. There we go. So you have a pedestrian connection there, and then you also have a pedestrian connection to Thackeray Place on the bottom to promote that urban connectivity for pedestrians. The project itself includes a phased approach. You have three phases. The northeastern portion and first stormwater pond are part of phase one. The orange color is phase two with a second stormwater pond and that connection to Thackeray Place. And then phase three is the green on the western edge with a connection to the school. And it's connecting to a park designated property, which is a track that is connected with the school at this point. This is a depiction of the road network. The blue indicates that these are public roads. The red is a private driveway. So as you can see, most of the public roads, most of the project site is served by public roads, which have specific design requirements, including frontage improvements, landscaping, lane widths, and sidewalks. So this road network is demonstrating that you do have access consistent with Kitsap County Code. Something else, I'm going to move backwards to our overall site plan. So So this area where the arrow is pointing, we have a sewer lift station that is outside of the required buffers for the Barker Creek corridor and the Island Lake shoreline designation. Central to the project site, we have a transit stop. So we have a transit stop centrally located that is accessible through sidewalks. The stormwater component is those two large ponds. Most of the site drains to those ponds. There are a few dispersion trenches that exist on the northeastern edge, but still outside of the 85-foot reduced standard buffer. Okay, this is the site plan that shows the landscaped areas. So this is the 17500. It identifies what kind of landscaping you're going to have. It's also, as I mentioned, it's going to have the buffers on the northwest and south, that it can be a separation buffer, which is a combination of fence and vegetation, or just one of those. There's a fence required on that project site on the western edges. On the right side, between the rural property and this project, is a solid screen buffer, which that is much more stringent to reduce the view impacts from adjacent properties, and around the stormwater ponds down there to the southeast. Landscaping and open space recreational areas. These are more formalized areas that include top lots or, you know, picnic benches, things of that nature, where it's providing amenities within the neighborhood on top of just the landscaping that is provided throughout that site plan. Close-up image of Camp Court Road, excuse me. Yep, I think I went past. Okay, sorry. So this is a detailed image of the Island Lake shoreline, where it's identifying the plantings required, and this is actually at a very detailed level compared to most preliminary plats. It gets into shrubs and bushes. Usually we're not getting into this level of detail, but it's demonstrating that you have numerous plants planting the shoreline, a little recreational area with picnic benches so people can enjoy the shoreline. Camp Court Road, this is the off-site improvement that triggered the mitigated negative declaration. So the improvements to this intersection with Island Lake Road. You have sidewalks that get out to that intersection point, travel lanes, making sure that is consistent with Kitsap County Code and the road standards. And then finally, this wanted to highlight the upper Barker Creek portion. So this image is showing that the bottom of Island Lake, and there's a control feature at the bottom of Island Lake to maintain the levels. And then you have the Barker Creek, the upper portion, is tightlined, is the term we use. And that is a man-made feature, a culvert that takes the water, channels it, and then daylights it at another location. So this is one of the pieces where the county, the early proposals included daylighting the stream, and comp plan policies specifically support voluntary daylighting of streams and restoring stream corridors with native vegetation in their buffers. So this area is an important component of the project. So this is the original proposal when the road, the second access road, was being proposed to go through the eastern parcel for second access. And it included a daylighting of the stream with establishing the buffers and replanting those buffers as necessary to increase their effectiveness of, you know, addressing water quality and quantity that goes into the stream. So I'm only down to two slides. We are almost done. Decision criteria. I'm going to actually go reverse here. So chapter 22500, that identifies the review criteria for a shoreline conditional use permit. That is the intent of Title 22, is to go through those criteria. It is in the staff report. It's long. It's verbose. Did not want to include it in a slide presentation since it's already in written form. But we found that it did meet the criteria for the shoreline code. The thing to note is in our shoreline code, we have a table that identifies what permits are needed based on the use. And our table references a conditional use permit, does not specifically reference a shoreline conditional use permit. So we also added 17550030 to make sure we addressed those decision criteria for a general conditional use permit as well. Don't believe that that is required by code, but it does meet the criteria for that element as well. So we wanted to just be safe and make sure that it met those criteria. So with that, the department does find the proposal consistent with the comprehensive plan, goals and policies, that the project is compliant with Kitsap County Code and other applicable regulations. We would say that it is compatible with the characteristics of the property in the immediate vicinity and not materially detrimental due to the fact we have conditions of approval on the project that address the impacts that could be created. So we are recommending approval with conditions as seen in section 13 of the staff report. And that concludes my presentation. I know there's going to be plenty of questions that come out of this, and I'm willing to answer those as they come up.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Gurney. All right, and just for scheduling for today, we've taken roughly a 10-15 minute break every about 90 minutes, and I'll say we'll do a hard 12:30 for lunch hour, so everybody can plan on that. We'll take a lunch break from 12:30 to 1:30. So with that, let's move on to applicant comments and who's going to be our applicant representative at this point.
It looks like Duana online, so I'm just going to move her over so she can talk.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Duana Koloshkova here. I don't know, are there video options as well? I'm happy to do either. Just a little worried about the black screen. And we do have a presentation, flat presentation slideshow we'd like to share. So if we can also have the ability to share screen, that would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Again, my name is Duana Koloshkova. I represent the applicant Sequoia Springs in this matter. And I would like to introduce our team, confirm a couple of exhibits, and then I will turn this over for the project presentation by our principal engineer, Holly Hebron, over at Core Design. The other folks that we have as part of our team today are Carolyn Decker over at Terra Associates, who provided our geotechnical soils analysis, Joanne Bartlett, who provided our critical areas review, and Jeff Schramm, our traffic engineer, who provided our transportation impact analysis review. We also have with us available for the hearing examiner and public response to public comments, Colton Costers at Radeke Associates, who performed an independent critical areas review, and Scott Kindred of Kindred Hydro, who is a hydrogeologist and provided independent review as well. I also have a few legal comments related to the project and a list of proposed revisions to the staff report proposed conditions of approval that I would like to go through after the examiner hears the presentation on the project.
I'll just jump in real quick. Ms. Koloshkova, I'm going to remove your ability to talk, and then I'm going to promote you as a panelist so you're able to show your camera and stuff. So just one second.
Thank you, Mitch.
It'll be just a second.
Thank you much. Good morning. And I will ask if we can, while I go through a couple exhibits, if I may, could we also request Ms. Hevren to be promoted as a panelist because she will provide the applicant's presentation on the project, if that's acceptable. Thank you. So as I understand it, there were a couple of documents that I think were inadvertently excluded from the list of materials in the staff report that should be, I believe, part of the plat file and are on record and have been available for public review. One is that geotechnical addendum that Darren mentioned, and then the other is a cultural resources report which the applicant circulated to the hearing examiner's clerk and others earlier this week. So I would request that those be included as part of the underlying project exhibits.
And Ms. Jones, I see we have 62 as a cultural resources assessment. Is this,
okay.
is this a
yes.
different report?
It appears to be the same. And I do have the other one that we can admit as well. I can assign that an exhibit number.
Okay, so is that correct, Ms. Koloskova? Is basically cultural resources report, is that already exhibit 62 possibly?
It could be. I did not receive an updated list of exhibits after the staff report, so I don't know, but I'm sure that's correct because we didn't circulate that. And then we also provided and would request that the examiner admit the applicant's plat presentation that Ms. Hevren will be providing this morning, as well as the applicant's requested revisions to the staff report proposed conditions. We believe those are common, normal materials to be included in a record for the open record hearing, given that the applicant bears burden of proof, and we would like to provide our presentation to the examiner this morning.
Okay, just to provide a little detail on the geotech addendum, do you have the date of that and the author?
The author is Terra Associates, and I will have we will have Ms. Decker provide a short summary of her review, so she can give the date, although I believe it was February 29, 2024.
Okay.
But
all right.
She should be listening in.
Okay. I'll just ask you at this point for the geotech addendum from Terra Associates from February. Anyone have any objections over entering that document or need to see them? Like I said, if you're the virtual hand at the bottom of your screen, or if you're in the room, wave your hand. No takers. I'll go ahead and admit Exhibit 66 is the geotech addendum. And let's wait for when the applicant presentation and the conditions are formally presented, then I'll admit those as well so that people have a chance to see what it is before I put
and
it
I
in
may
for
have, if I'm, hmm? I may have the wrong date on that, so I don't want to be confusing on that point. Maybe it'd be best if I defer to
Okay. All right. Let's see. I wait for her then. All right.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
So if I may, I guess we can request that the examiner admit the applicant's plat presentation and proposed revisions to plat conditions now, or I could just ask for that at the end of the applicant's
Yeah, let's do it at the end after so people see what it is and have a
I'll
chance.
Go ahead
so
do that.
I know what they'd be objecting to if they were. Okay. All right. Anything else before we go to Ms. Decker?
We will go to Ms. Hevren.
Oh, sorry, Ms. Hevren. Okay.
Thank you much. That's everything for me for the moment.
Sounds good. Okay, Ms. Hevren, I'll have to swear you in there. Just raise your right hand. You swear affirm to tell the truth and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
And just to make sure we got the spelling right for the record, is that H-E-A-V-R-I-N? Is that correct?
Correct.
All right, great. Okay, go ahead.
Great. I'm going to share my screen, do our presentation. I will upfront say for everyone listening in, there is duplicate information in here between what Mr. Gurney has already provided and what we are proposing. But as Ms. Koloskova noted, as it's our burden of proof, we wanted to be sure to be concise with our findings. So give me one moment to share, make sure. Okay, So this is the applicant presentation for the Meadowview preliminary plat and shoreline conditional use permit. As Ms. Kloshkova introduced, we do have our team of experts here. Every single one of the people listed here are in attendance today and are available for questions and will be available every day of the hearing. The site itself is three parcels, totaling 55 acres, all within the urban growth boundary. They are listed as three separate addresses as shown, and there is an easement provided across parcel, we'll call it 2004, moving forward, but parcel 2004, that is on the eastern side of the property, an easement only for stormwater purposes. Our site access is via Camp Court Northwest. And like I said, the site is within the UGA and has been since 1998. And the zoning designation is urban low residential. So our site boundary versus project limits, we did feel that there was a little bit of confusion in the staff report as written, and we wanted to be perfectly clear that the site boundary is the three parcels within the UGA, 2006, 2008, and 2009, and that to the east, parcel 2004, is not included in the project site. It is used, there is an easement being established for use of stormwater purposes only. So the site boundary itself was used for all calculations for density, recreation requirements, open space requirements, landscape requirements. The area offsite was not utilized. And the civil plan, preliminary and landscape plans, exhibit F50 in the lower corner, lower left corner, had this explicitly stated in the site statistics. Site history, as Mr. Gurney described, it was previously used as a commercial recreational resort facility, as existing cabins, outbuildings. In October 2021, the property sold, and we submitted for preliminary plat in 2023. Permit history, we did submit for the preliminary plat in 2023. We had also submitted at that time for a shoreline substantial development permit. That was actually the incorrect permit to apply for. So that has since been withdrawn, and a shoreline conditional use permit was submitted. And that's why there's a separate application dates for those two permits that are currently under review. Notice of applications were sent in September, and then as Mr. Gurney noted, resent in November due to a permit number error. The existing conditions of the site is mostly forested, a sloped hillside. The outdoor camp facilities currently still exist on site. And then we do have critical areas of the Island Lake shoreline, as well as off-site wetlands and streams that are on that parcel 2004. The proposed development will include three phases. Residential development totaling 329 single family homes, will include open space and parks, a extensive public road network, stormwater and utility infrastructure, and our current permits are the preliminary plat and the SCUP, and then future permits will include a site development activity permit known as an SDAP, right-of-way use permits, and building permits. The shoreline conditional use permit was triggered because the northern parcel lies within the Urban Conservancy shoreline management per Title 22-600. And the subdivision is a conditional use within the Urban Conservancy. So that's what triggered this additional permitting process. The residential standards within the Urban Conservancy are all met within the provided plan set. And with the SCUP, specific measures must be met and complied with, which is part of 22500-100D3. And we've shown that single family residential within the UGA is consistent with this RCW. The existing site is private and does not currently provide any public shoreline use. The site is within the UGA and zoned urban low, which complies with the comprehensive plan. The proposed use of the site is similar to those areas northwest and south. And no impacts to the required buffers are proposed, which results in a no net loss function of the shoreline. The project complies with all applicable code, state and county code. The cumulative impact analysis was included within the habitat management report. And single-family residential isn't allowed use for the parcels within shoreline jurisdiction. We wanted to note as well that within that 200-foot shoreline jurisdiction, we are not proposing any residential lots or structures. What we are proposing only is open space as well as the critical area buffer that's associated within that 200 feet. And single-family residential isn't allowed use within the Urban Conservancy. Land use for the site is, like it says, urban low, comprehensive plan, urban low density residential. Single family detached homes aren't outright allowed use within that zone. So the zoning itself, we wanted to point out that the site has been within the UGA since the comp plan was first adopted in 1998. Was the county's first GMA compliant comprehensive plan. So it's not a change of zoning with this. It's been decades since this has been within the UGA. The density of the site, as urban low, the minimum density is 5 dwelling units per acre and the maximum is 9 dwelling units per acre. As proposed, we are providing 329 units, which is nearly smack dab in the middle of the allowed density. So we are at 7 dwelling units per acre. This is shown on page C1.03 of Exhibit F50. The permitting process through Kitsap County, we received our letter of completeness. Notice of application has occurred. CEPA threshold determination has occurred. The noticing of the hearing has now occurred. We are currently at the public hearing stage. Next steps would be, of course, the decision by the hearing examiner and then noticing of that decision. The project is proposed to be phased. The first phase is shown in blue, approximately 112 lots. The northern stormwater facility pond will be constructed at that time, as well as the dispersion trenches into Island Lake. Open space and amenities will occur within that phase. The sewer lift station will be constructed, as well as the pedestrian facility bus stop that's central to the site, just off of Road A. The orange second phase is about approximately 110 lots. The second stormwater pond will be constructed at that time. Additional open space and amenities will be constructed, and the pedestrian connection up to the site boundary, which is near Thackeray Place. And then third phase, 107 lots, again, open space and amenities, and the pedestrian connection will be constructed up to the to our property line, there's a further slide that details this further, but it connects to the parcel that's directly east of Emerald Heights Elementary. Phases collectively exceed the code requirements, and no requirement is dependent on a future phase. So phase one may have excess open space, let's say, but as phase two comes on, when we join phase one and two, collectively, they have the required amount of open space. Project-wide statistics, again, the densities that we have proposed. The recreation and landscape space, you can see that we are in exceedance of the required. On-street parking is in exceedance of required, as currently shown. Off-street parking does not include private driveways, so it is just the, it does not include private garages. It's just the private driveways, so there is two spaces per private driveway. Again, all of these required and provided calculations are within the three parcels within the UTA. Nothing is utilizing the off-site area since it's just an easement. Recreational open space, we have over 4 acres of recreational space. Private parks are within each phase, the largest park being in phase one at the northeast side, and we exceed the requirements as 139%. Some of those highlights include a nearly 3-acre park at the northeast side, pocket parks, and pedestrian connections throughout the site. Total amount of landscaping through the parcel is over 10 acres. This is, again, in exceedance of what is required throughout there. You can see these areas shown in green are all as areas to be landscaped or native vegetation to remain. And again, there is nothing included in the off-site parcel. Infrastructure improvements for the project are, they include stormwater infrastructure improvements. This one will collect and convey stormwater on site into pond, into two ponds that are on the eastern parcel in 2004. Flow control, which is water that is the detention or holding of water generated on site, will occur within the two ponds. Water quality, the treatment of the water before it leaves, will occur within the pond. And additional voluntary water quality has been added on site via a bioretention swale, two bioretention swales, that further treat the water before discharge. 5 dispersion trenches will also collect and disperse clean water into Island Lake to assist in maintaining hydrology. The site is served by Silverdale Water District, and water mains will be extended through the site. Kitsap County Public Works Sewer will be extended through the site, and a lift station will be installed at the terminus of Road A outside of all critical area buffers. For fire, turnarounds are provided throughout the site. A looped road system was designed in such a way to ensure fire protection. And sprinklers will be required on every building on the project, on the plat. We have a phased build out for power through PSE. And for roadways, most of the roadways on site are public right of way, which will be dedicated. A public bus stop will be provided central to the site and 2 pedestrian connections. The sanitary sewer lift station is shown at the terminus of Road A near the intersection with B and Roads D and E. The lift station is just north of Lot 121, and as you can see, it is outside of the 100-foot, 50-foot buffer. This includes the 150-foot buffer off of the piped portion of the stream, and it's also outside of the 200-foot shoreline jurisdiction. Off-site improvements, Camp Court will be widened to current county county standards, allowing for two-way vehicle traffic, and a pedestrian access will be provided via a new sidewalk on one side. Water will be extended within Northwest Island Lake Road and looped through the site. As noted before, a vast majority of the roads proposed are public right-of-way. These will be dedicated to the county. The looped system, multiple loop systems through the site were thoughtfully designed in that fashion. All of the private roads still meet fire turnaround requirements and can be used as a turnaround from the public right-of-way as well. As noted, site access is via Camp Fort Northwest. That roadway is only currently approximately 13 feet wide. It's very narrow and does not allow for two-way vehicle traffic. Development will correct this existing deficiency, and the single access point is limited for the site based on topography constraints surrounding the property. Unfortunately, it's not feasible to meet anywhere near a county road standard for slope and connect anywhere along the property boundaries. So due to that one single access point, all of the homes will be required to have sprinkler systems. And this has been approved by the fire marshal, which is reflective on the cover sheet of Exhibit F50. This note for fire sprinkler suppression systems was direct verbiage from the fire marshal. As noted, we do have two public pedestrian connections. All of the roadways that were shown as public will have public sidewalks adjacent to them, which connect to both of these pedestrian connections. In phase three, there will be a pedestrian connection through open space 12, which connects to this parcel, which is actually owned by Kitsap County Parks and Rec. It is located just due east of Emerald Heights Elementary. And then in phase two, a pedestrian connection will be provided up to the property line that is near Thackeray Place. Parking and transportation, we are providing two off-street parking spaces as required in each individual private driveway. Garage spaces are not counted, but we expect each of these homes to have a two-car garage, which would provide the residents additional parking. On-street parking is required at half a space per lot, so 165 spaces are required, so we have to round up. And we have 179 currently shown. And then, as noted, a public bus stop is also included within phase one. A traffic impact analysis was completed by 10W. The study areas were confirmed with the county and WashDOT staff. They studied over 15 off-site intersections and three existing roadway segments. All the studied intersections are expected to operate at acceptable levels of service with full build out of this project. And the traffic fees will be paid by the developer to the county. So stormwater, getting into kind of a drainage overview, there's two existing basins on site. There's a basin which drains to Island Lake, and there's a basin that drains to the Barker Creek basin. The developed basins is kind of split into three basins simply because the Barker Creek basin is going to have two ponds, so that has been effectively split into two on-site basins matching the same discharge point. And then for the Island Lake basin on the north end, that will be mitigated with dispersion trenches into the lake. The dispersion trenches are placed outside of the lake buffer. I know Mr. Green noted that they will be placed outside of the 85-foot lake buffer. They will actually be placed more than 100 feet from the lake to ensure that the full 100-foot flow path is provided before the ordinary high water of the lake. So those flow paths, the water will disperse and infiltrate within the buffer and get directly into the lake. This will provide additional hydration of the lake and the Island Lake aquifer, which is discussed in the hydrogeological report. The areas collected for dispersion are clean roof water only. There won't be pollution generating impervious surface that's collected and drained to this. So by way of doing this, all threshold discharge areas are maintained. For the two ponds on the eastern parcel easement, these two ponds will collect the majority of the on-site stormwater. These ponds each have an outlet and discharge in a southeasterly direction outside of all critical area buffers. there's a Barker Creek buffer as well as a wetland buffer on this, on the eastern side of these ponds, and all components of the ponds are without of the, with are outside of that. Water will enter the ponds and be held so that we can match existing conditions and match existing flow rates. The outlet of the pond is regulated by a control structure so that we match these rates. And then from there, water will flow through a voluntary bioretention swale for additional treatment. And then it will outlet to a dispersion device and slowly spread out and discharging into the in the southwestern direction. Sorry, southeastern direction. Water will discharge and disperse through the buffers, infiltrating along the way, assisting with recharge of the Barker Creek aquifer. This is also discussed in the hydrogeological report. Both of these outfall designs are both ponds and their outfall designs are shown within Exhibit F50 on pages C4.51 and 4.52. The easements for access, construction, and maintenance of the stormwater facilities will be submitted to Kitsap County for review and acceptance. We have added this language to approval, to condition of approval 56. We've requested it to be added, which will come up at the end. And water quality is provided by each pond by way of dead storage. And as I noted, the additional voluntary bioretention swales have been added as a secondary water quality treatment. This was done to address the concern brought up by the Suquamish tribe, specifically the tire byproduct on the 6PDD and 6PDDQ, which is, there's another separate memo which further details that component that is in Exhibit F47, a water quality treatment memo. Island Lake and Barker Creek, we wanted to discuss the relationship between these two components. The currently Island Lake has an outflow restrictor at the south end of the lake. This restrictor was put in place to ensure that Island Lake maintained water levels. There's plenty of docks and components along the lake that the water level needs to stay consistent to support those. The when the water drops, the Silverdale Water District supplements the lake level by pumping water into the lake. This is an agreement that's been in place, I believe, since 90, I can find the date, but it's been in place for decades. And they will continue to do that. Dispersion trenches from our northern property will discharge clean water into the lake to increase lake hydrology. Theoretically, that could potentially reduce the need for Silverdale Water District to augment the lake level as much. It won't replace it, but it may help. The flow restrictor at the south end of the lake exits at approximately elevation 216.5, and then daylights another 400 feet south, roughly at 215 elevation. Our ponds are another 1,200 feet south of that and discharge at an elevation of 204 feet above and 202 feet. So there were some comments about daylighting the piped section of that creek and as mitigation for our pond outfalls, but there's no mitigation component that's alleviating it as our ponds and our outfalls are so much further south and lower in elevation. So easements for access, construction, and maintenance of the stormwater facility where our ponds will be placed has been added, proposed to be added to language for condition 56. The draft easement shown herein is included to depict that the easement provided is fully outside of the critical area buffers for Barker Creek, which is shown in pink, and I'm sorry, Barker Creek, which is shown in orange, and the wetland A buffer, which is shown in pink. This easement is also fully outside the shoreline jurisdiction. And so no incursions or impacts are proposed with this easement.
Okay.
critical areas analysis was completed by Joanne Bartlett. The Island Lake has a required buffer of 100 feet per Kitsap County Code 22-400-120. The standard buffer reduction, which is allowed per code, is 85 feet. The buffer reduction of 85 feet is what is currently shown on our plans. We understand that this buffer reduction requires mitigation, and mitigation is expected and will be provided at the SCAP level. We also understand the risk that if the mitigation is not found acceptable, that the 100-foot buffer will be required to be implemented. Barker Creek is a type F stream with a 150-foot required buffer. We are proposing a 150-foot buffer. We are not requesting a reduction to that buffer of the original or the daylit portion of Barker Creek, nor the piped section. And I emphasize that because there is within, I should know the number, one of the previous documents where we had the habitat management plan, exhibit F8. It does show daylighting of that creek because we, in a original submittal, had a road crossing it. That road has been removed. But in that daylighting of the creek exhibit, it showed a reduced 50-foot buffer request. We're not requesting that for the piped section that's to remain. Wetland A is a Category 3 wetland with a habitat score of 7, which requires a 110-foot buffer. A 110-foot buffer is proposed. No reduction is requested. And the shoreline designation is Island Lake is a type S water, which is an Urban Conservancy shoreline given its location, and no structures are proposed within that. So we have no impacts to on-site, off-site, critical areas, or other buffers with the part of the development. Geotechnical analysis was completed by Terra and Associates. 41 test pits were completed. 20 were originally done in March 2021 and another 21 done in 2022, including 8 test pits done in the off-site easement area to ensure that our bond was properly signed. Additionally, 11 borings were done between 2022 and 2024 so that we could get a deeper understanding of the soil components. As stated, it is our responsibility to meet burden of proof. We have met that, and the preliminary plat makes appropriate provisions for public health, safety, and general welfare. The project as proposed is consistent with that county's comprehensive plan and current zoning regulations, all applicable code and policies, and all necessary infrastructure. We have reviewed staff report in thorough and the recommendations and conditions of approval. We have a separate document prepared, which we will bring up at a later time, with our requested revisions to the conditions. At this time, I would like to have a few of our team members give a brief introduction of themselves and the role that they've played within the project. I myself, Holly Heverin, Core Design, principal engineer, have been with this company actually for 19 years now. Core Design has been the lead civil engineer and as well as the professional surveyors for the site, the landscape architects, as well as all the planning for the site. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Carolyn Decker to introduce herself.
Okay, and Ms. Severin, is this pretty much the entire PowerPoint presentation you have? Is that right?
Yes, this is me. Oh. I'm wrapping it up.
Okay, let me, well, just want to get that into the record. Anyone have any objections over the applicant's PowerPoint presentation coming in? That would be Exhibit 66. If you do, just raise your hand or raise your real hand in front of Ms. Jones. All right, seeing no takers, I'll go ahead and admit the applicant PowerPoint is Exhibit 66, and let's move on to Ms. Decker at this point then. Ms. Decker, let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Carolyn Decker. I am the president of Terra Associates. We are the geotechnical engineers of this project. Been asked to give a brief presentation of what we've done from a geotechnical perspective to kind of understand how we approached the project and the various geotechnical components that we looked at. We first began this project in March of 2021. Prior to doing any subsurface explorations, we actually reviewed the geologic information that was available on the Washington State Department of Natural Resources Geologic Portal website. That's a mouthful, but it's there. That website has various components of geotechnical information that you can look at. It has a LIDAR, it has landslides, it has geologic maps, it has existing subsurface explorations, as well as numerous other things. Where we start is we look at the most recent geologic map that is available. This gives us an idea of the soil types that we would expect to encounter when we complete our subsurface explorations. When we looked at the 2013 map that had been completed for this area, one of the components that was shown on that map was a alluvial fan deposit. Now, an alluvial fan deposit is typically something that follows a landslide. So when you see this soil type, you really want to focus in on it because it could potentially be a problem for the development. So once we had seen that particular geologic mapping, we went and looked at the 2017 landslide study that had been completed by the Department of Natural Resources. And that didn't show any landslides in the area, at least not in the site vicinity or anything to the immediate northeast, west, or south. Knowing that, when we did our initial study in 2021, we focused some of our test pits in the area of the mapped alluvial fan so that we could either confirm the geologic mapping or see if there was any inconsistencies in that geologic mapping. And that isn't uncommon. Geologic maps are based on relatively limited data, which is why site-specific explorations are completed. So in March of 2021, we excavated 20 test pits between 6 and 12 feet below the current site grades. The results of that show that the majority of the soils on the site are outwash sands, ice contact sediments, weathered and unweathered glacial till. We did not find the widespread alluvial fan deposit that was shown on the geologic map. That, while not uncommon, was a bit surprising. We did expect to find something, and we didn't. So using that information, we prepared the geotechnical reports, paying specific attention not only to components that were necessary for development, site development and grading, foundations, drainage, stormwater, all sort of the typical components of a geotechnical report, but also to the geologic hazards. The site does have erosion hazard areas that will need to be taken into account during construction and during development. It does have components of the site that meet the definition of a landslide hazard. So as it had those components, it needed to be addressed in the report and it needed to be addressed during development. And what we found was the proposed grading removed those slopes and it removed those hazards so that at the end of the day, the project was actually going to be in a more stable condition than what we currently have today. Once we completed that initial study, it was sent off to the design team. We entered into discussions regarding the geotechnical components of the site. Particularly, we were looking at those slopes on the west side. The excavations that were proposed over there were quite deep, and we wanted to make sure that those were stable and completed in a safe manner. We proposed on that particular area terraced soil nail walls. That was evaluated and deemed a viable option, and so the project moved forward with that. We received a grading in early of 2022, and based on the proposed excavations for the grading and the location of the stormwater ponds, we recommended additional subsurface explorations. Particularly, we wanted to go out and do some deeper soil borings because we had excavation depths that were proposed that were over 30 feet. We wanted to ensure that we knew what we were going to get into when those excavations got that deep. Those additional explorations were completed in June and July of 2022 and included 21 additional test pits and 4 test borings that extended 40 feet below grade. We updated the geotechnical report accordingly, And the results of that round of subsurface explorations were consistent with the initial findings. We did not observe any additional indications of alluvial fan deposits. There was no, particularly in the test borings, there was no indication of a landslide deposit. We didn't find any sort of colluvium. We didn't find any sort of disturbed or muddled texture that you would typically find if you were in an area that had a landslide deposit or was of an ancient landslide. Following the work in 2022, grading continued. We were sent the grading plans in early of 2024, which showed the wall alignments as well as the proposed wall heights. At that time, we realized we needed to go out and get some more information, particularly along that west side, so that the soil nails could be designed appropriately and that we had the correct information for the depths that they were proposing. Seven additional test borings were completed. Those extended 40 to 60 feet below the current site grades, because not only do we want to get to the bottom of the excavation, we want to get below the excavation, so we really have a very clear understanding of the soil and groundwater conditions at the site. The results of those test borings were, again, consistent with what we had seen throughout the site. We had outwash sands, we had ice contact deposits, and we had weathered and unweathered glacial till. Following the completion of that round of explorations, we revised our geotechnical report, which is the June 20th, 2024 revised report, which I believe is in the staff report. I believe it's number 57 in there, so I think it's included. But if not, it certainly can be sent to everyone who would like to see it. That sort of concluded our geotechnical work, and I will now pass it on to Joanne Bartlett to discuss the wetlands and the critical areas.
Okay, Ms. Decker, what was Ms. Koloskova? I wasn't quite sure of the date of your geotech addendum. Do you have that?
I do. It's not an addendum. It's actually just a revised report, and it's dated June 20th, 2024.
It's Exhibit 57 in the pre-hearing index record.
Oh, it's already in there?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Perfect. Okay. All right. Let's. Sorry, Ms. Decker, who were you moving that on to now?
Joanne Bartlett.
Okay. All right. Ms. Bartlett. Bring her on up.
Let me see if I can find her. Ms. Bartlett, if you're online, could you just raise your hand?
Is she there yet? I don't have her on my screen.
Looks like she just joined.
I'm here.
All right, just kind of, yeah. That's it. Ms. Bartlett, could you say something again? Maybe you'll pop up on my screen then. I'm not.
Yes, I am here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, perfect. Okay. All right, let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear firm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
My name is Joanne Bartlett, and I am a local wetland biologist working for Ecological Land Services. I was hired in 2021 to conduct a preliminary wetland delineation, ordinary high watermark delineation, which were both done in accordance with the requirements of the Kitsap County Code and the respective manuals. And so we marked those and we GPS them just so that we could show them on our maps. And during our initial site visit in 2021, we looked at the map screen that comes from the southwest to the northeast. Sorry, my dog's barking. So we determined that there was no stream in that location and that a follow-up visit was done with Brittany Gordon of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife at that time and Allison O'Sullivan of the Suquamish Tribe, and they both concurred that there was no stream in that location. Additionally, we reviewed the area where the eagle nest was mapped, and we did not notice any nest at that time. I understand there was a comment about there being one now, but it was not present at the time we conducted our site visit. I did also conduct a secondary visit to identify the ordinary high watermark of Barker Creek, beginning at the end of the culvert from Island Lake, and also and then I did another follow-up visit to identify whether or not the floodplain, map floodplain, was actually functioning as a floodplain, and found that it did not meet the requirement at this time. And I also noted that there will be no development proposed within the map floodplain as it coincides with the 200-foot shoreline jurisdiction. I believe that's it for me.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Bartlett. Anyone else from the applicant team at this point?
Oh, yes, yeah, go to Jeff Sharan, please.
Okay, all right.
Thank you. And Mr. Examiner, we have last consultant is Jeff Sharan, who I think is being added now, and then I have some comments. I know it's a little after 11.
Yeah.
We probably still have, Mr. Sharan will speak for 5-10 minutes, and then I have, I would like to make a couple legal comments and go through our proposed revisions.
So. Oh, okay. Well, maybe let's take our break now then, I guess, and we'll take a break until 11:20. We'll see y'all back at that time.
Recording stopped.